to David against Caterpillar. Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Warner. Same law firm. My name is Mr. Warner. Good morning. Caterpillar's request in this case is simple and straightforward. What we are asking is that the discovery rules simply be enforced according to their terms. Rule 37C provides that a party is not permitted to use as evidence at trial information if, without substantial justification, is not disclosed as required by Rule 26A or to Rule 26E1 unless that failure is harmless. The DECO allegation regarding Mr. Mitzvah was never disclosed under Rule 26A, was never a subject of amendment to our interrogatory answers that provided it that information should be disclosed. So there is a failure to disclose. And we would ask the court to consider the precedent that would be established if the lower court's decision were to be affirmed. What that would say is, and that case would be cited, every time someone intentionally withheld significant evidence or was careless in discovery and failed to find significant evidence in time and came forward on the eve of trial and asked that that information nonetheless be admitted. This case would then stand for the authority that the rules wouldn't necessarily be applied in accordance with their terms. Look what happened in this case. As we were scurrying around to prepare a defense to five different promotion claims, at the last minute we found out about the significant new information. Caterpillar was not in a position to investigate it thoroughly and prepare a defense. And look at the position this put the district judge in. On the day trial was to commence, with a jury waiting, the court had to make a significant judgment without an opportunity to research the law on it, without an opportunity to reflect on that judgment. We believe as a result the judgment was erroneous. But this whole problem could be prevented if there is a clear precedent that discovery
was harmless error.
Pardon?
Why isn't this harmless error? You already knew about and put on the stand the only other person who claimed to have heard the conversation.
There were five captains, first of all, who were involved in the decision to select Ms. Flusher.
I understand that, but the conversation that was the subject of this testimony supposedly occurred with two people present, and both of them testified.
That is correct.
So why isn't it harmless error?
But
there was no other witness to the events who could have been located and put on the stand with more time.
There were certainly any number of other witnesses who could have testified to substantially undermine the credibility of this statement. For example, all the three other captains who were now retired from Caterpillar and may have been more credible than the employees who testified at Caterpillar, who were intimately involved in the deliberations about this promotion. They could have certainly testified. Nothing was ever said about the pending litigation. There may have been evidence about interest in promoting women under the affirmative action plan, but the tag at the end of that DECO testified to, that there was some reference to litigation, seems to fit the facts of this lawsuit too conveniently. Secondly, there's evidence that DECO discussed what he heard with others. We would have gone out and investigated and talked with others. did he ever say anything at the time inconsistent about what Mr. Feld told him as compared to what he testified at trial? And again, I think it is highly likely that the tag about the litigation may not have ever been mentioned by Mr. Deco at the time he discussed this with others. So we would have done an extensive investigation, and we had no opportunity to do that when we found out about this information. Plaintiff contends there was a substantial justification for the failure to disclose. What she cites was that this was revealed to her counsel in a privileged conversation. There are two problems with that. Rule 26 provides that the fact of a privileged conversation must be disclosed, that there was such a conversation. If at any time the plaintiff had suggested that Deco had some relevant information, even if privileged, instead of assuming, as we did, that his only role in the case was someone we were going to rely on as a male comparable, we would have deposed him. We couldn't have asked for about the privileged conversation, but we certainly would have asked him about all of the promotion issues and whether he had any facts related to those, and we would have found this out on a timely basis. Also, we believe the plaintiff, Deco, was willing to waive the privilege at the time of trial. There were 21 months in which the plaintiff could have sought that waiver. And in fact, we believe that plaintiff's counsel was in a conflict position until she asked for that waiver. The court below said we were not prejudiced because we had an opportunity to interview Mr. Deco. Well, Deco only went on a 41-person witness list that was basically simply a list of everybody whose name was mentioned in the deposition index, and the only way that it had come up in discovery was when we cited him as a possible male comparable. This would set a tremendous precedent if someone could simply put a name on a witness list without complying with the discovery rules, and then that witness could testify to anything at trial if the other party did not then subsequently interview them. The point was, the plaintiff had an obligation to disclose what information he had. And what is significant here is we moved immediately to assert our right when he appeared on the list to demand that the plaintiff demand that the plaintiff fulfill their obligations under the discovery rules by sending them a letter saying, there are a number of people you listed. We've heard nothing about them in the Rule 26 disclosure or in the interrogatory answers. Are these people really going to be called? And if so, give us the information. That letter wasn't even responded to. We filed a motion in limine some days before trial. We never got the information in response to those motions in limine. There was no compliance and no substantial justification for it. The other point that the court below made is that this case could nonetheless be sustained because the jury may have decided that the plaintiff was more qualified than Ms. Slusher. Well, unfortunately, the lower court did not have the benefit at that time of the subsequent Millbrook decision that established what the standard was for determining when a argument over relative qualifications could sustain a position in support of a pretext argument. And in that case, the court held that if relative qualifications are going to prove pretext, the plaintiff's credentials would have to be so superior to the credentials of the person selected that no reasonable person in the exercise of impartial judgment could have chosen the plaintiff. Now, in this case, there can be no dispute that that standard was not made. In fact, the evidence points the other way. This job is primarily a firefighter's job. Prevention of fires and taking command in fighting fires. Joni Lusher, the person selected, had been a firefighter in her community for many years, had been a captain in charge of fighting fires. You couldn't find anyone who had more prior relevant experience. The other thing that was looked for was leadership potential. Joni Lusher had been promoted to a supervisory position in a prior employer. She had taken a lead in a very major project regarding computerization and barcoding of the equipment. Therefore, there can be no question that because Ms. David had none of these qualifications, that the Millbrook standard was not met. I'm eating into my reserve time. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Warner. Ms. Papakronis.
May it please the court, I'd like to take this opportunity to address the issues that have been brought before you by the defendant in this case. Defendant's biggest argument is that there was tremendous error with respect to the introduction of Dekow's testimony and that this mandates reversal. This is simply not the standard under which Rule 37 operates. Rule 37 very clearly states that exclusion is not mandatory if the violation was harmless. And that is precisely what the district court here found. And what defendant fails to bring before this court is that that decision is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. That is a very high standard under which this court has said can only be met in one of four ways. First, the decision was completely arbitrary. Well, that clearly isn't the case here. Second, there is absolutely no evidence to support the judge's decision. Once again, that is not the case here. Third, that the court relied on an erroneous conclusion of law. Well, that's not the case either because Judge Mim appropriately applied the standard of Rule 37. And finally, that the court relied on a clearly erroneous factual finding. Well, it is undisputed that the district court got it absolutely right when it determined, first, that defendant had over 17 months' notice that Dekow would
had
be had
notice written. Of the man's name, but not of the subject of his testimony. And, of course, the whole point of Rule 26A1A is to require notice not simply of people's identity, but of the subject of their testimony. To say that what gives me trouble about the district court is the district court says, well, knowing their name is enough. And that's exactly what Rule 26A1A says is not enough. One can read the district court's opinion as saying, I'm just not going to enforce the subject matter notice requirement in my court. It's not something district judges can do.
Well, I think the district court did not simply rely on the disclosure of the identity in order to determine that this was not harmless. The district court, as Your Honor properly brought out earlier during defendant's argument, also determined that it was harmless because Mitzelfeld, the only person who could dispute...
Well, I agree. The judge determined it was harmless, but the judge seemed to start from the assumption that notice of a person's identity is enough, and that's a legal mistake.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I do not believe that the court ever said that it was harmless simply to only disclose the identity and not the subject. That wasn't the court's holding at all. The court instead held that the defendant was able to put on a defense regardless of the late disclosure of the subject of his testimony. And there are additional facts in the record to support the district court's decision on this issue. Most importantly, the defendants did learn before trial what the subject of Dekow's testimony was. And in fact, defense counsel found out before plaintiff's counsel that Dekow would be testifying on the stand. Plaintiff's counsel had repeatedly attempted to get a hold of Dekow to see whether or not he would appear. Dekow would not return her phone call. It is at that point that defendant called Dekow in themselves, and he willingly told them what he would testify to. At that point is when DeKalb finally agreed to speak with plaintiff's counsel. And immediately upon getting that consent, the very next morning, plaintiff's counsel called defense counsel and told him that DeKalb would be testifying exactly to what he told them before. That's what DeKalb told plaintiff's counsel, that he had told them that information. And at that point, defendant's counsel, the day before plaintiff's counsel disclosed it to defense counsel, knew exactly what was going to happen. At that point, the defendant filed a motion to bar DeKalb and argued that they would be unable to adequately present a defense for only two reasons. First, because they did not have the opportunity to depose DeKalb. And second, because they did not have the opportunity to speak with Mistelfeldt and could not find him. At that point, plaintiff's counsel called defendant's counsel immediately, informed him that DeKalb was under subpoena and that we would be willing to, at any point in time, allow the deposition to take place. Second, plaintiff's counsel then disclosed the exact information so that they could talk with Mistelfeldt. And in fact, defense counsel did talk with Mistelfeldt before trial. There is no substantial prejudice that occurred to the defense. Further, the defendant's position also misstates the opportunity that it had to rebut the impact of DeKalb's testimony. It urges that that three captains were missing who could have also testified to dispute DeKalb's testimony. Well, first, as stated before, they could not have directly disputed it because they were not present for the conversation. But more importantly, Richardson, one of the primary decision makers in this case, was present at that meeting, did testify, and defense counsel did not ask him whether or not such a statement was ever made at that meeting. Defense counsel had the opportunity to do so and didn't take it. Additionally, they also called Bechner and Ruxlow, the upper management personnel, and asked them if such a thing happened. They denied it. Further, defense counsel did not ask for a continuance despite the fact that the court told them the court would wait and would not allow DeKalb or Mistelfeldt to testify until they had the opportunity to take their deposition. Defense counsel declined this opportunity. There is absolutely no evidence in the record to suggest that defense counsel could have put on any better defense had they been given more time. I think it's important to note that there was a four-month time span between the time that the jury rendered a verdict and defense filed its Rule 50 motion. During that time, they submitted an affidavit of Richardson to state that there were three captains who had retired, but it did not submit an iota of evidence that suggested that if it had more time, it could have found anything. In 4 months' time, it discovered nothing. This suggests that it didn't ask for a continuance because it knew there was nothing more than it could do. Defense counsel in this case...
I'm kind of puzzled. The motion in question had to be made within 10 days. It can't be made 4 months later. You mean the motion wasn't made for 4 months or that it wasn't briefed for 4 months?
What happened in this case is since there was a bifurcated trial on damages, after the jury returned its verdict, there was briefing regarding the issue of back pay, which took place over the course of a couple months. And as a result, the final verdict was not entered until after, some months after. And it was because of that briefing with respect to the back pay and prejudgment issue that there was that time lag.
So you're saying the motion was timely with measured with respect to the final decision?
Your Honor, quite honestly, I would have to go back and look to see whether or not the exact time frame, but we did not argue in our briefs that it was untimely. But without looking at the exact time frames that it was filed in, I wouldn't be able to honestly answer your question. Although the defendants did file their notice, make their motion timely after the briefing of the back pay argument. Essentially, the district court on May 14th recognized exactly the type of strategy that the defendant was engaging in, and that was this. We don't want to know because we want to be able to claim prejudice later. the district court on May 14th said, I understand why they declined to take their deposition, because if they had, they'd have no room to now claim prejudice. And this court should not sanction such a willful attempt to make that situation one that could possibly support reversal. Instead, they had an obligation to do their best to try to win the case at the time and not simply hope that on this issue it could later have an opportunity to try to find something to appeal. This is an abuse of discretion standard. There are plenty of facts to suggest that no harm occurred, and the district court did not abuse that discretion. Defendants then argued that there's, without Decow's testimony, there is not sufficient evidence to sustain the verdict. Well, this, quite simply, is false. As first, defense counsel talked about the qualifications issue and that under the Millbrook standard, it would be inappropriate to simply rely on a comparative qualifications issue to determine that she was retaliatorily denied promotion. But that misses the point and the facts of this case. It's very distinguishable. In Millbrook, the only evidence that the plaintiff had was the issue of the comparative qualifications. Here, which I will describe in a moment, we have more evidence than that. Second, Millbrook was a case where it was undisputed what the criteria were for promotion. And the court twice in the decision specifically notes that unless the plaintiff is able to show that there is a problem with the veracity of those qualifications being proffered, we can't look any further. But in this case, there was plenty of evidence to suggest that the qualifications that were articulated were not true. We could see that the qualifications issue was really a sham because there were no standard qualifications. Furthermore, what qualifications applied differed depending upon the person as well as the promotion at issue. The defense argues repeatedly that Joni Lusher had this critical fire experience, and that, along with her leadership capability, what made her an appropriate subject for promotion. However, that completely ignores the fact that the promotion before Lusher and the promotion after Lusher.
What is, your, in your view, your best evidence of retaliation?
I think we have to look at the record as a whole. I believe that
When we look at the record as a whole, what evidence in it is best for you?
I believe that probably the best evidence is the amalgamation of the hostility that is displayed towards Ms. David immediately following her filing of the charges. The fact that when they articulate a qualification, it changes depending upon who the person is. Rebecca Smith also testified regarding circumstances that can lead us to believe that Schilling was in a state of mind to also retaliate against David, and as well as Decow's testimony. We look at all of these things together.
I don't understand, actually, this whole business about Decow seems a tempest in a teapot. I don't understand how it helps your case in the slightest. You know, what Decow said is that he overheard somebody who was involved in the decision say, we have to promote a woman. Well, that would be very good evidence in a suit by Decow, as apparently he was planning. It's not very good evidence in a suit by another woman.
Well,
she's in the favored class of that statement, not the disfavored class.
What Decow stated was that Mr. Fault said that they had to promote a woman in order to defeat a lawsuit that had been filed by a woman in East Peoria. The only lawsuit and the only woman out there who had filed such a lawsuit at that time was Lori David. The inference can very easily be drawn that Caterpillar was engaging in a course of conduct to ensure not only that it would defeat Lori David's lawsuit, but also that when a woman was finally promoted, it was not going to be her. And that was retaliatory.
Well, you've recounted it differently, actually, orally, from the way both sides recounted in their briefs. The way it's recounted in the brief is a statement that Caterpillar would have to hire a woman because of a lawsuit filed by another woman. Did Decow say that the statement was, have to hire a woman to defeat a lawsuit filed by another woman?
Honestly, Your Honor, I would have to look at the transcript and look at that exactly.
I think it's quoted in both briefs as saying because of. Now, if what's going on is a woman files a lawsuit pointing out that there's been discrimination against women, that they're being excluded from the security supervisor position, that doesn't imply that they won't hire the person or that they're determined not to hire the person who brought this fact to light. As rephrased by you, it strongly supports that inference. But it may not be what testimony was.
Well, I believe that when the statement is made that they're taking this action because of that lawsuit, and the woman who's promoted is not Lori David, who had more seniority than Joni Lusher, strongly spoke that this
Here's the quotation from the transcript. He had been told by upper management that the next promotion in the department would have to be a female in response to a lawsuit that was recently filed in East Peoria by another female security officer. You know, it's actually not uncommon for people, after something has been pointed out in a lawsuit, to try to rectify the problem in the lawsuit. And one would think that that ordinarily represents a success in the lawsuit, that is, the person has achieved the objective, rather than a penalty heaped on the lawsuit.
May I respond, Your Honor? I see my
yes,
time.
Yes, please.
If that's true, which we respectfully disagree, I understand your question to be that you're saying you don't believe that this was evidence.
I just quoted you what the actual testimony was, and it doesn't say to defeat the lawsuit. It just says, in response to the lawsuit, we've decided we better promote a woman.
I think that, then, is an issue of drawing an inference, which is perfectly permissible for the jury to do. It's within their province to draw inferences based on the evidence. And while we might disagree, we would be overstepping our bounds and not giving deference to the jury's finding.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Papakronis. Anything further, Mr. Warner?
We agree with the last point Court made, that it's a very difficult to draw the inference that when fact...
Of course, if you really agreed with my point, you wouldn't spend all this time in your brief complaining that the testimony was admitted. You would say the testimony itself, if admitted, was harmless.
Yeah. I think point is we understand the burden we are always under when we challenge a jury verdict, and what is...
Exactly your point. Yeah. You've come here saying that this testimony was damning, it cost us the case, and that implies a position on your part that it supports the verdict. Well, one can't really have it both ways so easily.
The point is, and what it really emphasizes, is that the jury obviously did make an inference from this of retaliation, because all the other evidence that the plaintiff refers to was the same evidence argued in support of all the other four promotion issues, including two retaliation cases.
But you're not disagreeing that the jury could properly draw that inference.
I think it's a very, very it's a very difficult inference, but it's obvious that they did draw that inference, or it appears obvious, because that is the only piece of evidence regarding the Lusher promotion that was different than all the other evidence.
My question was, did they improperly draw the inference?
I believe they did, because there was no evidence that, in fact, that Lori David was then talked about and said, we are not going to pick her because we filed a charge. It was only a very loose inference that presumably was drawn for the jury because of this testimony that the Lori David issue was allegedly discussed by Mr. Mitzefeld. But that emphasizes the importance of our opportunity to investigate it, because we had to get everyone who witnessed the conversation that Mitzefeld allegedly told Deco about. And those conversations occurred in a meeting with at least three other witnesses that did not have an opportunity to investigate or to track down and discuss it with, and we had no opportunity to find others who might be able to testify that Deco talked inconsistently at the time. And let me emphasize the issues with respect to the other evidence. Again, the most fundamental point, that can't support the verdict. It didn't support, in the jury's mind, liability in the other cases. And the only evidence that purports to support this verdict are relative qualifications that are precluded. The plaintiff's argument is precluded by Millbrook, and the DECO testimony that never should have come into evidence. Also, with respect to the harmless, not harmless issue, we never found out about everything that DECO ultimately testified to until he testified at trial. There were two conversations. He happened to reveal one of the conversations when, I guess the one mistake we made in this case is being a little too careful in interviewing him, even though we had no idea what he was going to say. But we found that out, one of the conversations, on Thursday before trial. We did not find out that he was going to be called as a witness till Friday evening before trial. We never found out about everything he was going to testify to until he actually testified. That is clearly not harmless. Thank you. We ask the court to reverse the case with directions to enter judgment for defendant. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Jarrell against Roman Haas is on for argument next.